thank you very much. I was asked if I would come and speak on something that I didn't have to prepare much for, which just shows you what they think of you. But anyway, no, it's a great privilege and pleasure to be with you. I thought I would talk about justification by faith, partly because it is very central, of course, to our faith. It's not talked about as much as it should be, and it has become an issue of some controversy in recent years. I don't think we should be surprised by this. I think that it's one of the ways in which theology works, that when a subject is disregarded for a long period of time, and, you know, it has a way of resurfacing, and sometimes with some virulence, taking over. I mean, the doctrine of the Trinity, for example, a generation ago, nobody talked about the Trinity very much. I mean, I used to get invited to preach on Trinity Sunday because the preacher didn't know what to say, in the church, and it would wheel somebody in, who'll keep them happy for an hour. So, this kind of thing. Or, indeed, I'm old enough to remember when the Holy Spirit was not talked about, in respectable circles anyhow. Then the charismatic movement came along, and pretty soon no one else was talked about. It kind of went the other way. And when John Stott wrote his book, The Cross of Christ, which I think he published in 1986 or sometime around then, he wrote in the foreword of it that he'd done some research on the subject and found only two books in the previous 50 years that he'd come across written on the subject of the atonement that he could find. Now, of course, I'm sure there were more, but the subject had been neglected, relatively at least, within evangelical circles. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is that people tended to assume, well, we all agree about it, so let's talk about what we disagree about. And this tends to be the way, isn't it, that people skip over the things that are not controversial and concentrate on things which are, with the result, of course, that the next generation who comes along doesn't realize that we all agree on it, doesn't even know what it is, because they've never really heard much about it, and so we find ourselves reinventing the wheel again because the younger generation which has come up has never seen one somehow. It's just moved along. And in a way, I suppose, the discussion on justification by faith is like that. For this reason, I think it's a good thing that it comes back. We mustn't be afraid of controversy and the fact that it has re-emerged in this way, and the fact that it's stirring people up, because it is a central issue. I mean, I'd far rather we'd argued about this than, say, the millennium, for which we're all waiting. But, you can argue one way or the other, and frankly, it doesn't seem to me that it makes a whole lot of difference what you think, because when it comes, it will come, whether you like it or not. You see what I mean? It is a corrective sometimes to our way of thinking about these things, and in this sense, a valuable one. In the last couple of years, of course, the controversy has focused on the two books, one by John Piper, which I've got here, The Future of Justification, and the other by Tom Wright. I've got the British edition. There is an American edition. This is the British edition, Justification, God's Plan and Paul's Vision, there, which he wrote in response to Piper. And I want to sort of focus on those two things, because not because they're the last word on the subject, of course, but because they're written for a popular audience, and they're kind of digestible in a way. I know both of the authors in different contexts. Perhaps I ought to, in the interest of full disclosure and so on, tell you what my connection with them is. My connection with John Piper is is much less than with Tom Wright in every conceivable way. I met him, I think, at Beeson Divinity School for the first time about 10 years ago, when he came to preach in chapel and packed the place out. And I said, "Who's he? Why? I'd never heard of him, and I couldn't understand why anyone else had." And he was sort of a guru in certain circles. And so I thought, "Oh well, I better go and find out about this." And then I got to know him a little bit and liked him as a person very much, and really got to know him in the summer of 2006 when he was in Cambridge, at Tyndale House in Cambridge, writing this book, in fact. And I said, "Well, can I have a look at this book, and, you know, what you've written?" "Oh, yes, fine, you know, if you make any suggestions." And so I read through the book, and I realized, you see, here he was. He was reading everything Tom Wright had ever written and writing on him, but had never met the man. I didn't really know anything about him as a person. And I was reading through this, and I thought, "Oh, my goodness, you know, you can't say this and you can't say that," because it was just, you know, factual things that he'd picked up, sort of deductions from writings, but just that weren't true, you know. For instance, he said he was writing his PhD in Oxford, whereas in fact he was writing it in Cambridge in Tyndale House. For Oxford, but writing it in Cambridge, and it's one of those things, you just don't make that mistake, you know. And I was sort of putting, and I realized, you know, that he needed a little bit of education in this matter. I was able to sort of pull his leg, because he'd been invited to preach in Northern Ireland. And I knew the church where he was being invited to preach, and I knew that he was coming. And there were some students from Beeson who were there on summer placement of some kind. And I said, "You know, you're going to find that the front row, when you go to preach in this church, there will be a bunch of Americans there." And he said, "Well, how will I know?" I said, "Well, because they'll be the ones with the baseball caps." And you can always tell Americans, you know, very clear. And I said, "And they don't want you." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, they haven't gone all the way to Northern Ireland to hear an American preach. They you know, they want to hear one of the locals." So he said, "Are you sure about that?" I said, "Yes." I said, "You know," I said, "they're very disappointed that you're going." So, which was true. So, so he went over there and spoke, and apparently, according to what I heard later, he stood up and said, "I've been told you don't want me here, at least the Americans." So they all had a good laugh at that. But anyway, he got on very well. He's actually got a very good sense of humor, and he's a very humble person. And this is why I'm telling you this, because this may not come across. You know, you may not think that if you only see these people from a distance. But it does come across, I think, very much in the book, you know, which he wrote out of great concern, personal concern, because he was finding people in his congregation were being misled, as he saw it, were changing their views on justification by faith, and in his opinion, losing their hold on the gospel. Right, that was his motivation. And he put a great deal of time and effort and research into it, which is particularly commendable, I think, given the fact that he's not a scholar as such. I mean, he's a pastor of a church. He's a busy man, of course. He took the time out. He thought it was sufficiently serious to do this and sit down and write this book. So you have to see where he's coming from, and what he's doing and why he did this. Now, of course, he has limitations. We all do. But this is the way he was approaching it. Tom Wright, on the other hand, I've known much longer. We are the same age. I mean, I'm 2 weeks older than he is. So we are, in effect, the same age. I knew him when he was a student in Oxford a long time ago. Not very well, but I didn't know him. I knew him when he was writing his PhD. That's how I know it was in Cambridge, because I watched him do it. And I followed his career different ways at different times through his life. And, of course, I know that he's a bishop now in the Church of England and so on. He's a very prolific writer. He's a very engaging speaker. Undoubtedly very gifted in many ways. And, somebody who can fire the imagination. I mean, when he speaks, you know, he gets you on his side, and he's very very attractive in that way. He's also done an excellent job, I think, in standing up to the Jesus Seminar people over the years, in his evidence for the resurrection and so on. And this is really probably what his lasting legacy in the scholarly world will be. His work on the resurrection and generally on the life of Jesus. And he has quite, I think, courageously stood up, in that way and against that. When it comes to Paul, however, Pauline theology, he's been less successful, I think this would be fair to say. And this is not just a reaction to Piper. That's a minor thing. In a way, all kinds of people have taken objection to what he has to say about Paul, ranging from E.P. Saunders on one extreme, right through, I suppose, to Piper at the other end, but including people like Jimmy Dunn, for instance, James Dunn. I never know what people call these people. See, I call these people by the names that I know them as, but over here you tend to use initials. J.D.G. Dunn or something. I think, who? N.T. Wright, who? I have to think who these people are. But, so Jimmy Dunn and so on is another one, who incidentally, Tom dedicates the book to Jimmy Dunn, says on the front page, although I disagree with, or he disagrees with me, nevertheless he dedicates the book to him because Dunn had dedicated a book to him. You scratch my back. Anyway, yeah. So, it was a bit like this, but anyway, so they're in contact like that. But also including people in Germany like Peter Stuhlmacher, for instance. I don't know if you know about Stuhlmacher, but from Tübingen, who came to Beeson Divinity School some years ago and held up one of Tom wrote a book called What St. Paul Really Said. And Stuhlmacher holds this book up like this and says in his sort of, slightly charming German accent, there is only one word I would change in this book, like this. And he sort of said, what's that? He said, it is not what St. Paul really said, but what St. Paul never said. And otherwise you can, leave the book alone. So, this is I'm saying this because it's important to realize that the way the debate has sort of focused at popular level, or seems to be focusing at the moment at popular level, in some ways, is a reflection, but is also a misrepresentation in a sense of a much wider debate, which involves different people. And to say that it's kind of Piper versus Wright or something like that is to simplify. That's really the point. It's a very simplistic way of looking at it. You need to realize that Tom Wright is very much standing on his own, more or less, in terms of his views on Paul and on justification. I mean, it's not as if he represents some consensus of opinion and John Piper dares to stand up like David fighting Goliath or something like this. I mean, this is not a fair picture of what is going on in the scholarly world as a whole. So you do need to appreciate that and understand that. Where does Tom get his views from? I would say Tom Wright is basically a hyper-Calvinist, which may strike you as odd. But if you want to read about this, his very first book, which he wrote with some other people, John Cheeseman was one of them, Michael Sadgrove was another, and I forget who the fourth one was. There were four of them. They were students in Oxford at the time. And they wrote this book called The Grace of God and the Gospel, which may still be in print for all I know, it was published or is published by Banner of Truth. Is it still in print? I think it probably is too. And if you want to study Wright, you want to know about where Wright is coming from, read that book. It's only 120 pages, so it shouldn't take you more than a week or so. Well, this is football season. I mean, you have to read it in commercials, I know. But he's coming at this, you see, and from this angle, and you'll get a good picture of this. Now, of course, if you went up to Tolman with that book, I mean, he'd hit you over the head with it, I'm sure. Deny ever having written it, say it's somebody else, and all the rest of it. But it is important to understand, because the framework of where he's coming from, the thought pattern, which guides his way of thinking, is very clearly visible in that book. What I mean by this is, he thinks in terms of system, of framework. And of course, this is hyper-Calvinism, isn't it? In the hyper-Calvinist view of life, you have the covenant, and the covenant controls everything. And everything else, Israel, Jesus, you and me, everybody, serves the covenant. You see, Jesus is the servant of the covenant. He fulfills the covenant and so on. But he's basically subject to the covenant rather than being lord of the covenant. Whatever the covenant says, this is what Jesus does. You see, he's the sort of agent who fulfills it. And it's a method, it's a way of thinking about theology, putting this abstract notion, as the guiding light, and making the work of Christ, the saving work of Christ, fit into that. And of course, once I say that, if I put it like this, and you grasp this principle, then you can understand Wright's views on justification a lot more easily than you otherwise would. Now, why will Tom Wright deny that he ever wrote this book? I don't know that he would deny it, but not be very happy if you reminded him. He has, of course, moved his theological position to some extent, but this was mainly because of the influence of a man, of his PhD supervisor, actually, in Oxford, called George Caird, C-A-I-R-D, who is a... Well, he was a New Testament scholar, died in 1984, I'm going to say, something like that. You might not know of him very well now. He did write a few things, but is not terribly well known today, but was an advocate of a certain way of looking at salvation history and so on. And, he sort of managed to get Tom sort of oriented into a slightly different line from what his sort of original hyper-Calvinism would have led him to. And so he's kind of absorbed modern biblical studies from a more liberal sort of viewpoint, but keeping, nevertheless, the same basic fundamental perspective. This is the thing. This is a combination of these two things, which makes him very unusual in the theological world, because you cannot say he's a liberal in the way that, say, E.P. Saunders would be a liberal. Ed Saunders is a liberal in a different kind of way, the new perspective on Paul. And of course, if you ask Tom, do you subscribe to the new perspective? Oh, no. I don't. And in his mind, he doesn't, you see, in some ways. But on the other hand, if you ask him whether he's a Calvinist or an evangelical or something like that, he tends to kind of back off that as well, because he's reading sort of Banner of Truth and this sort of thing and sort of pulling away. So he's kind of in the middle, not one thing or the other to some extent, but at the same time, a little bit of both. And he can sort of, move from one to the other depending on who he's with, and so on. Now, this is true. I mean, and fair enough. And he of course, sees himself as being in the middle. If you read his books, And this is typical of Oxford people, I'm afraid. They all see themselves as the middle way. And, you know, they find someone to the left of them and someone to the right of them who they damn to eternal punishment. And then, you know, present themselves as the solution, the thesis, the antithesis, and I'm the synthesis, you see. This is their technique. And whether you're Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, or Tom Wright, or whoever you are, this is the way you behave, this is the way you argue, and it's got Oxford written all over it. And so once you know that and realize that, you know, you can get along with this as well. Understand that that's what they're doing. It's a debating technique. You see, present yourself as the answer, while other people, you know, languish in the outer darkness, as it were, that you have created for them. You need to sort of bear this in mind as well. Okay, when you're dealing with this. Well, these are the two sort of worlds that have collided, as you might say, you know, in these books, and it's important that you understand this. It's also, I think, important to understand that something happens when you cross the Atlantic in either direction. I don't know why this is, but you see, when you go to England, names like John Piper sort of fade into the background. Very few people have ever heard of him. He wouldn't be a common, a well-known name. Neither would Mark Driscoll, I'm glad to say. But that's another story. We'll talk about some of that. But anyway, but you know, some of these people who are sort of gurus here are not sort of well-known over there necessarily. And this you have to bear in mind. The reverse, of course, is also true, you know. I mean, I'm constantly being told over here that Alistair McGrath is Britain's leading evangelical theologian. And, of course, at home, no one will go anywhere near him, you know. Who? We don't do this. And C.S. Lewis was an evangelical. That's another surprise. You find out when you come to America, you know. Especially if you go to Wheaton. I mean, it's a sort of, you know, the temple of C.S. Lewis. You know, I mean, not that we have anything against C.S. Lewis, but what makes you think this? You know, where did you get this idea that he was an evangelical? In fact, somebody, I think it was Roger Olson, even wrote a book about 10 leading evangelicals, and the only non-American he included in this book was C.S. Lewis. And I thought, what does he think an evangelical is? You know, I'm nothing against Lewis. Don't misunderstand me. Lewis was a great person, very orthodox Christian and so on, but he certainly wasn't an evangelical and would have been very upset if you had suggested that he was. Well, because he didn't want to be. You see, he didn't want to be labeled in that way. He just wanted to be a mere Christian, as he would put it. You see, mere Christianity. And any suggestion that he would wear a label other than that would have upset him greatly, I think, at the time. So this is odd. So, and Tom is in this category too, you see. He sort of comes over here and sort of great defender of Christian orthodoxy, etc. And we're all a bit puzzled by this, you know, from our side of the pond. We don't see it in quite the same way. So, you know, that also has to be borne in mind, a different perspective here. And I would be guilty of this as well. So what I have to say may come across, you know, sounding rather different, if you like, in this respect. Well, when it comes to the question of justification by faith, what are we talking about? First of all, of course, we're talking about the whole question of righteousness. What is righteousness? And in particular, what is the righteousness of God? And we who speak English as our mother tongue have a problem with this, which is to do with the English language as much as it is to do with anything else, certainly not to do with Hebrew or Greek or Latin, where there is no distinction made between the word righteous and the word just. So, whereas we would talk about justice, justification, justify, and so on, righteousness, righteous, and use these words slightly differently, sometimes. I mean, justice for us is a different concept from righteousness in the sense that justice is a public thing, an external thing in our minds, doing right by other people sort of thing, whereas righteousness is a moral characteristic of ourselves. You'd be righteous in yourself rather than doing something right to other people necessarily. So the meaning of these words tends to vary in English usage. And when you're translating from the New Testament, for example, we have to choose. We have to decide whether we want to say just or justice or whatever, or whether we want to say righteous or righteousness. And in choosing, of course, we are limiting, or at least, distorting, you might say, our perspective on what the thing really means. So this is a problem we have, a linguistic problem, which is difficult for us to overcome, all right, to begin with. And a lot of the I say this because a lot of the discussion, a lot of the argument, could probably be avoided if we didn't have this problem. False oppositions would not be set up between two different things. So that's one thing we have to bear in mind. And particularly when it comes to interpreting a phrase like the righteousness of God. What does it mean to say that Christ is the righteousness of God? Can I be righteous? And so what would that mean? And so on. And of course, the person they like to criticize, these people, and in this sense, Tom Wright would be aligned with the new perspective, although not part of it exactly. But the man they like to hate is Martin Luther, for reasons which I don't fully understand. But I don't think they've ever really read Martin Luther. I think that's true, because if you things are said about Luther which are clearly not true by people of this persuasion, and it can only be because they haven't read him. I think what they have read are 19th and early 20th century Lutherans who have made claims about Martin Luther which are dubious, shall we say. To put it mildly, so stressing faith as opposed to works, that they forget that Luther was not against works. Luther was very hot on works and the necessity of works for people who were already justified. What he was saying is you didn't become a Christian in this way, but when you are a Christian, then you must demonstrate your Christianity by works. Now, of course, we tend to associate this way of thinking with John Calvin. And, of course, one of the interesting things about reading this book, as you read, is that Wright sets Luther up against Calvin. You see, Luther bad, Calvin good. Which is very interesting, but what he doesn't seem to realize is that on this question of justification by faith, Calvin was not anti-Luther. If you take the trouble to read Luther and then read Calvin, it's very hard to see any difference between them at all on this subject. And indeed, if you go back to the 16th century, it would be very surprising that there would be any difference on this, because justification by faith was the one thing which made you a Protestant. If you didn't accept justification by faith alone, then whatever else you thought, you were not a Protestant. Of course, this was the unifying thing, and all kinds of unlikely people, even Henry VIII, who you wouldn't think would be justified by anything. on this point, you see, sides with Luther. Calvin sort of came along a bit later. This is the decisive thing, you see. So to say that they disagree on this subject, in the historical context, is very hard to defend, because of its centrality at that time. And of course, although Calvin did disagree with Luther on this and that, and certainly his followers did, and Calvinism and Lutheranism, went in different directions later on. A lot of Lutherans when that happened. Lutheranism split as well, and there were quite a lot of followers of Luther, including Melanchthon, who were more on the Calvin side. It was a much more fluid picture than we tend to imagine now. But certainly to picture this as a difference here on this particular subject, I think is a very dubious line to take. And to say that Luther was so pro-justification by faith alone that he saw no room for works at all is false. I mean, this is not, what Luther himself taught. And if you don't believe me, just read his lectures on Galatians, the second lectures on Galatians, and it's quite clear on every page, what Luther is really saying, and very hard to distinguish that from what Calvin would have said, or indeed what you and I would say today on this particular topic, see, in this particular way. But the issue, of course, as it comes down here, is, in the context of the time, you see, what Luther was saying was that to be righteous in the sight of God is to be accounted righteous, that righteousness is imputed to you because of what Christ has done, the righteousness of Christ, and so on. This is imputed to you. Whereas the Catholic theology of the Middle Ages was saying that righteousness is not imputed so much as imparted, in other words, or infused, transferred to you, so that by the sacraments, by the working of the church and so on, you would actually change. You would become a different kind of person because you would have the righteousness of God somehow put inside you. You see, you would be changed in this particular way. And, of course, Wright sort of brings it, talks about this and says, this is not the Bible's way of talking. You see, this is the line. The New Testament does not speak in this way. That impartation, imputation, this whole argument is basically a legalistic argument of the late Middle Ages expressed in terminology which the Bible does not use and leading, of course, to division and differences of perspective and so on that falsify the gospel in the long run because the whole argument is expressed in the wrong kind of language and heading in the wrong direction. All right, that's the claim. And so the next stage, of course, is if we want to get back to what the Bible really says, we have to abandon this language. We have to abandon this way of thinking. And now this is where Piper and people like him come in, arguing on this, because they will say, the language of imputation and impartation and all that was the language used in the 16th century. It was; it had been developed in medieval theology. This is true. There is no way you can deny that. I mean, this is well known. It's not in the New Testament. Okay, that is also true. The language is not used in that way, at least certainly not as precisely as that. Does this mean that the debates which were going on in the Middle Ages and early Reformation period falsify the teaching of the New Testament? That's a whole other argument. And here again we have to be very careful because at the heart of the issue is this. Does justification by faith mean that you are changed somehow or other into a different kind of person to what you were before? Or does it mean that you are accepted in the presence of God because of something which has been done on your behalf by Jesus Christ, something which you cannot do for yourself, but which puts you in a different position before God? You don't change. You are still the same old sinner that you always were. But because of what God has done for you in Christ, you are accepted. You can stand in his presence because you are protected. You are covered. You are, whatever word you want to use, by the shed blood of Christ. In other words, that the righteousness of Christ, what he has done to satisfy the wrath of the Father. You see, the justice of the Father that needs to be accommodated, the sin must be paid for. He has done this, and although you have done nothing, you have not paid for it in any way, shape, or form, you benefit from this. You see, and therefore, you are accounted as a child of God. You are united to Christ because of that. That's the fundamental thing. Now, if you take this as the basic distinction, from the point of view of those who believe in justification by faith alone, that is to say, evangelical Protestants traditionally, those who think the opposite, you know, that you have to have a transfer somehow, or a change, you have to become somehow different, are people who cannot ever know whether they are saved or not. And indeed, if you are ever in dialogue with Roman Catholics or people like that, my advice to you would be, don't talk about justification by faith, because Roman Catholics will agree with you that you are justified by faith, and even say you are justified by faith alone. But they mean something different by this terminology. You see, and don't always realize this. You see, it's a case of how can you get to the root of what the difference really is. And my suggestion on this would be to say, don't talk about justification. Talk about assurance of salvation. Because if you say to them, I know I'm going to heaven when I die, they will say to you, how can you possibly know that? You see, this is presumption. They're not going to say to you, you're going to hell when you die, necessarily. But you see, there's purgatory, which is a kind of default solution for those who aren't good enough to get to heaven when they die, which is the vast majority of people. And just to remind you, purgatory, you see, in our minds, tends to be a variation of hell. You know, like my New Testament Greek class is purgatory, or my New Testament Greek class is hell, really means the same thing. But in theology, it is not the same thing. Because hell is a place of no hope, whereas purgatory is a place of great hope. You see, you're working off your sins for a purpose, and that purpose is to go to heaven. So you mustn't think of purgatory as a negative thing. You see, purgatory is a second chance. A chance to do after death what you didn't get to do in this life. Of course, it makes no sense outside of a context of, what Protestants would call salvation by works, but what you would call as a transfer of the righteousness of God, of the grace of the goodness of God, from God to you, and until you are fully transformed, fully changed, and so on, fully sanctified, you might say, in that respect. Then you can't get to heaven. I mean, you see this, of course, at another very practical level in the use of the word saint. In Roman Catholic theology, saints are a small number of people, relatively small number of people, who are guaranteed to be in heaven. Because, you know, you pray to them and they perform miracles. You know, you touch the robe of Saint Cecilia or something like that, and you are healed. You know, and I always like to say that here in the South, there are three saints in Southern culture, which I'm sure you know: Elvis, of course, Bear Bryant, and Dale Earnhardt. You know, these are the people you pray to. These are the people you see in Walmart and so on. And, you know, there are shrines to them all over the place. But the point, my point is, there are few of these people, you see. Yeah, you don't even know who Dale Earnhardt is, do you? I mean, how Protestant can you be? Anyway, you see, this is the thing. You see, this hero worship, in a sense. You see, of certain people, and the rest of us are not. You see, the rest of us are at a lower level. But of course, if you are Protestant, you see, we're all saints. You know, when the Apostle Paul wrote to the saints of the Church of Ephesus, he wrote to everybody. He wrote to you and me, you see. And yet, when you say that, I mean, even for us to say this, you see, you kind of do a double take. I mean, am I really going to go around calling myself a saint? You know, and what are people going to think if I say that about myself? Which just shows you how difficult it is for ordinary people to grasp this concept. You see, justification by faith is not an easy thing to understand and to take on board. So this is what the underlying issue is. And I think if we look at it like this, whether you use the language of impartation or imputation or whatever, to my mind, is a secondary issue. This is not the heart of the argument. You know, you can do that and express the theology that way if you wish. If it's not helpful, if you don't use that kind of language and you'd rather talk some other way, that's also possible, as long as you keep this fundamental distinction in mind. Now, the question when you come to somebody like Wright is he throwing out the baby with the bathwater? All right, okay, he doesn't like imputation, he doesn't like that language. Throw that out. What about the underlying doctrine? You're saying, has he got a firm grasp of this or not? And this is very hard to say, because in throwing out the traditional language, what does he replace it with? And here, of course, things get a lot fuzzier. You know, it's not clear what exactly he replaces it with, because, in a sense, he's not really interested in replacing it with anything. What he seems to want to do is lift the discussion or turn the discussion into something else by changing your perspective on this totally. And when you look at this, the perspective that he wants to introduce is what I would call hyper-Calvinism. What he wants to do is, look at the covenant, whether he calls it that or not. I mean, sometimes he does, but you know, you call it the plan of God, the purpose of God, and so on. And the line he takes, or seems to take, is Israel was chosen by God, you see, to be the vehicle of salvation, somehow. All right. Israel failed in this. Israel didn't live up to what it was supposed to do. So, in order to compensate for the failure of Israel, God sends the Messiah. The Messiah comes along to do what Israel failed to do. You see, to take the place of Israel, in a sense. Now, in one sense, of course, we have to remember that this kind of thinking, this kind of theology, would probably not have been possible before 1945. And of course, why do I say 1945? Because it was then that people became aware of the Holocaust, the extermination of Jews in continental Europe, and of course realized all of a sudden the terrible history of anti-Semitism and so on, a history which we tend to forget now. You know, we forget that even around here, before 1945, in the 1920s and 30s and so on, Jews would not have been readily admitted to country clubs and all that sort of thing. There was a discrimination of this kind against Jewish people until quite recently, even in America. You know, it wasn't just in Germany or something like that. So there was this legacy, you see, which was there. And, of course, people swung the other way, you know. I mean, only now are a few people beginning to wake up to the fact that Israel can do wrong. But until recently, and still in certain places, Israel can do no wrong. You know. It can shoot Palestinians as much as they like and treat them the way they've been treated for 2,000 years by other nations all over the world. And people say, oh, well, that's Israel. Fine. You know, we support Israel, whatever they do. And these are Christians I'm talking about, not just Jews. It's too much. It's gone the other way. But it's only in this context, you see, where Israel is sort of elevated to a special position. And in compensation, of course, you see, the guilt feelings and so on for the Holocaust and things like that. And very understandably, I mean, I'm not saying that there's no reason for this, or you can't see why, but this is the context in which this has happened. Now, if you go back to Wright and look at this, you see, look at the way he's constructing things, it seems to me that the first question you have to ask is, and this is true of the New Perspective, what was Israel supposed to do? How was Israel supposed to be a saving agent in ancient society? What was the nation going to achieve? And of course, this is a very difficult question to answer. You can say, well, it was a light to the nations and, the law was given and all the rest of it, and they were God's people, and I'm not denying any of that. But they were, what was their mission? I mean, were they really going out to save the Babylonians and the Ninevites and the Egyptians and so on? And did they have any conception of this? What would they have said? If they had, what gospel would they have preached if they had any idea of this? Now, I'm not knocking Israel. Please don't misunderstand me at all. I think Israel was the people of God and so on. But it seems to me that you have to say to this, well, the purpose of Israel, the reason God chose Israel and so on, was to prepare the world for the coming of the Messiah. The coming of the Messiah was not a sort of second best because Israel failed. We go to plan B, and plan B is the Messiah. But the opposite, that Israel was being prepared for prepared in expectation for what would come. And when the Messiah came, Israel's mission was accomplished, because Israel had preserved the promises, the prophecies, and so on, until that happened. I would even say, for those of you who think I'm a terrible anti-Semite for even daring to suggest that Israel might conceivably do something wrong, Israel did not fail. You see, that's another thing. Why would Israel have failed? Israel didn't fail. Israel succeeded. Because Israel was still there, the temple was still there, the rites were still there, the law had been preserved, it was being taught and so on, when Christ came. This is not to say that Israel was perfect, no. It's not to say that there weren't a lot of things going wrong. Of course there were, and it had ups and downs over the years. But Israel had maintained the witness that it was meant to maintain. God had kept a remnant, you see, faithful until the coming of Christ. And that was a success, you might say, insofar if you want to talk in that kind of way. It's not really the failure of Israel. It was the completion of what Israel was meant to do. But, of course, what Jesus came to do was not to become Israel. And how could he become Israel? There's no match here. You see, a nation and an individual are two different things. What Christ came to do was to make atonement. The atonement which, of course, had existed within Israel, for Israel, as a witness to what God would one day do, permanently, on a permanent basis, for Israel. But not something that Israel, was supposed to do for itself. You see, if you have this Jesus replaces Israel kind of theology, the atonement disappears from it. If the atonement disappears or gets relegated to a sort of side issue and more emphasis put on the suffering, you see, that the suffering rather than the atonement, In other words, suffering is an end in itself rather than have a purpose in this way, a victory over sin and death. If that's what happens, you see, then whatever Jesus did and the new community that he followed and so on, I mean, is there really payment for sin? You see, and here, of course, this is where the new perspective people, and where Tom might be like that, start to get very vague. Now, if you push Tom on this, you see, you say, well, what about this? Do you believe that, you know, your sins have been paid for by the shed blood of Christ? He would probably say yes, because, well, he's had, a good Christian background. He's had it all, and he knows the truth in that way. So he probably agree to this. But what he doesn't seem to see, at least as far as I can work out, is how his theological construction that he's made doesn't connect with this. You know that there's two different things going on. And my reading of him is that he tends to jump. He'll produce his theological theory. Up to a point, and then when it's challenged, particularly by people like John Piper, sort of jump to his other foot and say, oh, no, but I do believe that, you see. And in his own mind, these two things have not really gelled together. They haven't really come together into one coherent whole. And that's my take on it, the way I understand it from what I read, and why it's so difficult to deal with, because if you challenge him sort of head on, he'll react with his other foot, if you see what I mean, and he'll say, no, well, of course I agree with that, that's not the issue. So, but then what is the issue? I think you get a good picture of this if you read just the opening pages. You just read the first two pages of this. And you see, he compares himself with Galileo or Copernicus, and somehow fuses him with Balboa, the Spanish conquistador. And it's astonishing, really, because he has himself, of course, who is the new of all of these, climbing to the top of the mountain. You know, the picture of Balboa sort of climbing the mountain in Panama and seeing the Pacific ahead of him and in front of this great new world which is opening up to him. And he pictures himself doing this. It's the confusion of Balboa with Galileo or Copernicus. Climbing the mountain is the main thing, seeing the vista. Whereas John Piper is a flat earther, who's still down in the jungle somewhere. And of course, along with Martin Luther and other flat earthers like this, and I'm not joking. This is actually what he says in the first couple of pages of the book. If you read it, if you want, this is I think what we have to see. You see, what Tom feels is that he has reached a higher, a new level, a new perception of theological truth, and his mission is to communicate this to others, and his frustration is that others prefer the flat earth, you say, to the Galilean universe, or the Copernican universe. And he's very upfront about this. He says it, quite clear, plainly in that way, and looks like this. Now, from a theological point of view, and this is where I'm going to end today on this subject, this is very dangerous. Because in theology, there really are no breakthroughs like this. I don't know quite how to put this, but theology as a discipline is the study of God. God has not changed. The word of God has not changed. What the Apostle Paul says, he claims Abraham believed. That's a challenge, of course, in itself. But the Apostle Paul would not have said, did not say, to his fellow Jews, I've discovered something you never realized existed, because if, you know, you hadn't stayed in Jerusalem, if you'd done like I'd done and gone to Damascus, you know, you would have seen this new vista opening up before you, but this didn't happen. You stayed behind, so you never had this experience. The Apostle Paul always, to the end of his days, said, I'm not telling you anything that is new. I'm not saying anything that hasn't always been believed by our people. You know, I am opening up to you the scriptures as they have always been written. Nothing new. You see? You have simply misunderstood or failed to see, because there's a veil over your faces, you see, or whatever it is. But the idea of moving on to a new stage would have been alien to him. Now, of course, we can turn around and say, but he did move on to a new stage, even if he didn't talk like that. And this is perhaps more debatable. But the point I'm trying to make is that if you are a theologian, you must be very careful if you are claiming novelty, because there is no real novelty. You know, there is a deeper understanding, perhaps, of what is already there, but that is a completely different thing. And this, I suppose, is my quarrel with Tom right in the end. I'm not saying that John Piper necessarily is absolutely right about everything. You know, he's just saying what he has to say. All right, he's challenging and so on, and that's good. And he's made an effort to understand, and that's very good too. But I am saying that Tom Wright's picture, and this would be true of any theologian who does this kind of thing, it's not a personal attack on him, please don't misunderstand me, who claims novelty, or to have discovered something new, is in a difficult and dangerous position. And this is what makes me sort of draw back from this and say, hang on a minute here. You know, you may have found problems with things and explanations and so on, and you may disagree with people for various reasons, but have you really discovered something that has not been known before? This I very much doubt. And, you know, until I have a lot more proof to the contrary, I'm not going to buy into that. And this is where I want to stop. All right?
We usually go until about 4:30, so we can take about 9 minutes of questions and comments. Anyone would like to ask a question or offer a thought?
I'd like to ask a question in the broader context of some of the theological distinctions of the Middle Ages, for example, the distinction between Abelard and Anselm, and mm-hmm. the whole language of objective and subjective. Mm-hmm. And how does, is this in any way, does this relate to this inability to accept the like the either or between impartation and imputation? Is that related at all?
Well, it's related, I think, in a more distant way. I think it's related in the sense that the claim is made, you see, that Luther and Calvin and people like that rejected the entire scholastic development, you know, from, say, the 12th century onwards, that whole thing. You know, whether it's Anselm, Abelard, whoever, Aquinas, it's all thrown out. And they're replacing this with what they call biblical theology. However, and this is the accusation made, that Luther and Calvin did not pursue their project to its logical conclusion, because they were stuck with the world they had inherited. You know, and they had to, well, either had to or they chose to speak in the language that they knew, and so that's what came across, you know, whether like it or not, and so the the claim today would be to say, well, Luther was inconsistent with himself. If he had followed his principles to their logical conclusion, he would have abandoned his arguments. He would have thought in a completely different way. Now, that's one of those things that, you know, who can say? I mean, whether this is really true or not. The point I'm trying to make is that even if that there's some substance in this, you see, there is still an underlying issue, and it would be quite wrong to say that somebody like Anselm, for instance, was making it all up. Those people, the scholastic thinkers of the, I suppose you call Anselm scholastic, maybe not quite accurate, but you know, that period. They were dealing with real issues, real problems, in the language and thought patterns of their time. And, you know, you can say, well, we've moved on. Okay, we've moved on in expression, perhaps, but not in substance. And it's dangerous if you say this, because you are liable to reject everything, you know. And there are problems here. See, how can I put this? The theological textbook that everybody used in the time of Luther was Peter Lombard's Sentences. The one major book of the Middle Ages that has never been translated into English is Peter Lombard's Sentences. I mean, this is incredible. It's rather like saying Calvin's Institutes has not been translated, you see. I mean, Calvin's Institutes replaced Lombard's Sentences in Reformed theology, and you know, Calvin's Institutes is modeled on Lombard's Sentences to a large extent. It's a response to Lombard. It's almost conceived as a replacement to Lombard. And of course, if you read Calvin's Institutes, which again is a minority pursuit, you know, lots of people bought it because it's cheap on CBD, but how many have actually read them? You find that you can't understand Calvin unless you understand Peter Lombard. You know, because those of you, if there's anyone here who's ever read Calvin's Institutes, you may not realize that all the time he's talking about the master of the sentences, and that you don't know who the master of the sentences is, and you've never read the sentences, of course, you know. You can't really follow what Calvin is saying, this argument. And it was a real issue, is it, arguing back and forth. And so I think this is a hole here. You see, we need to recover Lombard's Sentences, not because we want to go back to that, but just to understand what Luther and Calvin were actually saying, most of the time. Because they didn't read Aquinas well. Not really, and so on. They read the Lombard and what they got from him. So it's a key text, and we need to understand this. But the point is, he was dealing with real issues, real theological questions. To give an example, you see, he had a question and answer method. Well, the kind of thinking that they had. And it would be, they'd ask a question like, how many angels can stand on the head of a pin? And of course, this was ridiculed later on. What a stupid question to ask. But actually, it's a very important question, because the relationship between the spiritual world and the material world is what it's all about. Or did Adam have a navel? That's another question. Which sounds like a silly question to ask, but of course, it's all about creation and evolution, really. You know, when you get down to it, and these were the arguments that they were having. It's just the form has changed, and so we need to appreciate this before we start criticizing, saying, well, you know, what's going on in the 16th century? They were dealing with the heritage they had, of course. And the other point, of course, you have to make is that if Luther had not used the language of his time, who would have understood what he was saying? I mean, we use the language of our time, whether we like it or not. I mean, to give you an example, we talk about people being left-wing or right-wing. Well, where does this come from? Not from the Bible. I mean, this comes from the French Revolution. you know, in the way they sat in the assembly. I mean, the radicals on the left and the conservatives on the right. So we say left wing and right wing. Are we wrong to do this? Well, we're unbiblical. Or, you know, according to this, we'd be unbiblical. But everybody understands what we mean. You know, and we at least communicate, you know, in this way. We're using the language of our time. Now, if somebody comes along in 500 years and says, oh, those people back in the 20th, 21st century, you know, they got it all wrong because they borrowed this language from French revolutionary thought, and it's impregnated with Marxism and Freudianism and goodness knows what. They weren't Christians, really. You know, because they were like this. I mean, this would be to do us an injustice. And something like this is going to happen, I think. You know, I fear. And so we have to watch this. We have to say, well, look, they said what they said because that was the world they lived in. We don't live in that world anymore. But before we condemn them, you know, we have to say, well, how can we translate their issues into our issues? And I would say, yes, we can. And that the underlying issue of Luther, how do you get saved, is as vitally important now as it ever was, and is what the Apostle Paul was saying. You know, not to mention Abraham.
One more comment, question.
A number of years ago, there was a debate, as I recall, somebody will probably remember, between John MacArthur and
Hodges
on Lordship Salvation. Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. To what degree, do you have any sense for, I mean, it seems like it's a similar debate.
Yes, quite likely. I mean, you see, one of the difficulties is that there is a school, I don't know what to call them really, neo-Calvinist maybe, something like that, which revels in the 17th century. Right. I mean, they've never left it, you know. And the Puritans and all that. Now, I've nothing against these people. Don't misunderstand me. I mean, you know, the 17th century was no doubt a great time to live and so on. And Puritan theology is very good and very important. But it can become an idol. And the people who are sort of, you know, wrapped in this neo-Calvinist scholasticism, and it's typical of Charles Hodge and all that school, you know, the old Princeton and so on. Again, I mean, I don't want to throw them out or reject what they have to say or misinterpret them. I think that's very bad, and people do this. But they are also at fault for trying to preserve a way of thinking, as if preserving the way of thinking is necessary in order to preserve the substance. The form matters to them, you know. They've got to keep it, because any alteration, any modernization, any restatement will compromise the substance. And in favor of their point of view, you know, to understand, they're not entirely wrong. There is this danger. But without realizing it, you see, the people who lived in the 17th century didn't think this. They weren't wedded to their own ideas, anything like as much as the modern followers are. These people are actually followers of Marshall McLuhan. You know, the medium is the message. Change the medium and you change the message. We would say no. You know, because then the medium has tyranny over the message. The medium determines the message. And we would say, well, no, that's not right. There is a message which can be expressed in a different medium. My biblical justification for this, it would be a very simple one. And that is to say that the Apostle Paul and people like him, the New Testament writers, wrote in Greek and not in Hebrew. which they would presumably have done if the medium determined the message. They would not have abandoned the sacred language because nothing else was possible. But they did, showing that the substance could be translated without loss. And that's, I think, we need to remember that. All right?
Don't forget, there are, I believe, three more lectures in the scholar residence program. So I can